Welcome to the January 30th, isn't it? January 30th, 2022 edition of Meeting of the Minds. Our guest today is Peter Schwartz to talk about with me his new book, or the revised version of the previous book, The Tyranny of Need, which I heartily recommend to you. If you've read the preceding book, it doesn't matter. This is In Defense of Selfishness. It doesn't matter because you won't remember much anyway, at least I didn't. And we're all old now. So reading it is like reading it for the first time. And there are two new chapters at the end with dealing with foreign policy. So this is published by ARI and available on Amazon, I assume. Peter, is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Welcome. I wanted to begin, before we have a discussion, by talking about Peter's history and my history with Peter. Peter is a graduate of the Syracuse University School of Journalism, which you may not know, with a master's, right? Master's in journalism?
Yes.
Okay. And I first met him in my course at the New School, Introduction to Objectivism, which was taught in 1971. Now, there's about 20 students, a little less than that, of which Peter was the most diligent. And then he took it again in 1972. And out of 80-some people, he was the only one who took the final exam. And quite ambitiously tried to answer all the questions when I only assigned answering a selection out of all the questions. So you were there for hours in the room, as I recall, writing quite good.
It was overnight, I think, yeah.
Oh, overnight? Mm-hmm. So we stayed at the New School in Cots. So then in 1979, he started The Intellectual Activist, which brought him to widespread public attention and acclaim. Ayn Rand published a piece in it in shortly, you think it was about the sixth issue?
Yeah, it was, I think, in the spring of 1980, probably about the sixth or seventh issue.
And in her last Ford Hall Forum address, Ayn Rand described The Intellectual Activist as an antidote to today's irrationality. Is that correct?
Yes, that's her quote. Yeah.
Along with the Objectivist Forum. And she said to me privately, imagine having two Objectivist publications who are speaking to each other. As he wrote more and more for the Intellectual Activist, I came to know him better and better, and we would play volleyball in Central Park with friends on Sundays, and we grew closer and closer together. And then when the Ayn Rand Institute was formed in 1985, Peter was the chairman of the Board of Advisors. Is that correct?
Yes, right. Yes.
Okay. And in the next year, when we had successfully thrown a certain blonde psychologist off the board, both Peter and I joined the board. And the board was at that point Peter, me, Leonard Peikoff, and Ed Snyder. Then in 1988, Dr. Peikoff wanted to get off, and Ed Snyder was fed up with us. And so the board became just me and Peter, which it was for several years, I guess, 7 years. Seven formative years. Mike Berliner was CEO, but he was not on the board. So the three of us would meet to chart the future of the Institute and to guide it in its formative years. Meanwhile, Peter had come to wider public attention by virtue of his scathing critique of libertarianism. I thought originally he was soft on libertarianism, if you'll permit me, Peter. And then working on it, really, didn't that change your mind? Didn't that harden your feelings when you worked on that article?
Well, sure. I had a very different view of libertarianism at the beginning. When I started TIA, I was using mailing lists from various conservative organizations and some libertarian ones as well, which was a source of a sore point between Ayn Rand and me. In other words, we disagreed at that point. This was early, like in 79. I did not share her view of the wrongness of dealing with these libertarian organizations, of sanctioning them in some way. I thought, you know, they were mistaken, but they were like the conservatives. There were still some good people there, and I wanted to reach them and so forth. So that was why I was never, at the beginning, was not able to get her mailing list to use to try to solicit subscribers to TIA. It was only later on, which will be a different story for a different occasion, where we came to terms and as Harry noted, ultimately she publicly praised the intellectual activist at the Porthole Forum. So to answer your question, yes, when I was writing the article, it became clearer and clearer to me what libertarianism stood for. And this issue of, well, aren't there some good libertarians? It's just a red herring, meaningless issue. And the essence of libertarianism was the issue. And by researching a tremendous amount of libertarian literature, I was able to come to a different conclusion from the one I had started with and wrote this long monograph.
Was it three parts or more in The Intellectual Activist?
I think it was three parts in The Intellectual Activist, and then eventually was published as a separate booklet, and a further shortened version of it is in The Voice of Reason.
Voice of Reason. It's very interesting because that almost never happens where somebody starts with a certain view and does the research to write an article on it or a book or whatever and comes to not a radically different view, but a pretty strongly different view. You didn't change any of your fundamental beliefs about reality, but you came to see who they were much more clearly.
But two things. I came to see who they were, and it was clearer to me what one ought to do in dealing with people with fundamentally opposing views. So it was those two together, I think, that made the final conclusion.
Is it worthwhile talking about Walter Block, who wrote you after the first? I mean, as a case.
I don't know exactly what you have in mind. Walter Block, as I recall, was kind of the real exemplification of the amoralism of libertarianism. He wrote a book called I think Defending the Undefendable, something like that, where
right.
we had a whole a litany of people or professions that were frowned upon and which he was going to defend on libertarian grounds. And this included prostitutes and pimps and counterfeiters. He said, well, you know, the Fed should not, the government should not control the money supply, the currency. Therefore, there's nothing wrong with counterfeiting. Everybody should be free to cut. So it was a whole, almost
Reductio.
I'm sorry?
Reductio, right?
No, it was a, God, my mind goes blank with words. It was a character, that's the word I'm looking for. It was a, almost a caricature of amoralism when it came to, you know, defending these kinds of people. I don't know if that's what you had in mind with mentioning.
Well, after the first, yes, but after your first installment appeared, he wrote you a very friendly letter. Why don't we debate or something like that? Remember?
Vaguely, but I never pursued that, so I don't know what happened.
No, but that was a fascinating thing. You thought they're going to jump on me, and Walter Block wrote you. Really interesting. It's really interesting what you wrote. We should debate. Let's get together. Let's have dinner, you know, whatever it was. And I don't think you even replied, but you came out with the second installment, and we didn't hear from him again. Okay, yeah. So
that's another that's another good illustration of this obliviousness to ideas. So here I did. I've written a scathing denunciation of libertarianism and explained why they should be shunned and why they should be attacked and not dealt with. And he says, very interesting. Let's talk more about it. So it's just a complete disregard for any significance to ideas. It's all, you know, floating abstractions.
Let's turn now to your book, Enough History, and tell us first why you picked this topic, you know, for the original book. Why did you decide to write on that? You spent most of your life writing on politics and foreign relations. Why did you want to do this book?
Well, it was always the interest that I had in politics was basically an interest in ethics. That was my main concern. That was what drew me to objectivism. That was what I regarded as most important. That was what I would raise in discussions with people. Mm-hmm. So it was always ethics and what was right and what was wrong and so forth. So I wrote this book because I really wanted to help reshape the culture. We had a culture that was basically steeped in altruism. And I thought, some might say naively, that I'm going to write a really persuasive book and I'm going to show people exactly what is wrong with altruism and what is right with the alternative of selfishness, of rational selfishness. And this will make a real dent in the culture. So that really motivated me. And I spent, you know, over 10 years writing this book, and it came out in 2015, published by Palgrave Macmillan at the time under the title of In Defense of Selfishness.
Which was their title.
Yeah, I started with The Tyranny of Need. They didn't like that. The title was The Tyranny of Need, and I think the subtitle was An Examination of the Code of Altruism. So they didn't like it. They were very easy to deal with, but they didn't like it, I think, for two reasons. First, they didn't believe people would get this idea of the tyranny of need. It was too abstract, too academic to them. Plus, I think they preferred a more positive orientation from the title. So after going through a number of possibilities, we eventually agreed on In Defense of Selfishness, with the subtitle of Examining the Code of, with Why the Code of Self-Sacrifice is Unjust and Destructive.
Right. And it did decently, sold decently from what I've heard from you, but just not as much as one would hope.
Yeah, it did about 10,000 copies, which is nice.
That puts you in the top 1% of books published, I'm sure. Probably the top 0.2% of books published. But
I never researched that, maybe. But yeah. it was disappointing to me. And as I've spoken to you often, the most disappointing thing to me was the failure to get any reviews, any book reviews in reputable outlets, in reputable media places. I did get one from John Tamney, who was an editor at Forbes at the time, who had a name and a following. And that was indirectly because of you, Harry. You were friendly with him and you kind of put me onto him. And I think he did it maybe as a favor to you. But that was the single real review that the book got. It did get reviewed in Booklist, which is the journal of the American Library Association. This is what all libraries subscribe to, and this is how they keep track of new books that they're planning to stock. So that was a review there, but I think that was kind of, they almost always review books by established publishers, which Palgrave Macmillan was. But apart from that, there were no reviews, so that was the disappointing part.
Well, there's a question of how important reviews are in the internet age. How are your reviews on Amazon?
Well, all the reviews on Amazon, 99% of them were very favorable. There were some negative ones, but they were almost all favorable. There were some very moving ones, both on Amazon and on Goodreads, which is another site, which I can't explain exactly what it is, but it handles new books and solicits reviewers for them.
Okay. And then you got the rights back just last fall, I believe, right?
Recently, yeah.
And ARI came out with this new edition. Why did you do a new edition, and what do you hope to accomplish by doing that?
Well, the new edition is a paperback rather than a hardcover, so that's one reason to issue it. And the other, I added two new chapters at the end, applying all the principles that I named about self-interest and altruism to the realm of foreign policy, and explained how one defines a nation's self-interest as an application of, after one has defined an individual self-interest, and that is what shapes then a proper foreign policy. So I had new things to say in the book. It was a paperback, it came out, I had a new title. So I thought, let's issue this. There'll be perhaps a significantly new audience that this will reach. And I'm always trying to reach more people. This was a way to do it. And ARI cooperated, and I'm hoping, it just came out recently, so I'm hoping that it will be successful.
In the self-interest portion, no, sorry, national interest portion, you make the point you made in your foreign policy booklet, which has never been stated before in the history of the world, including Ayn Rand, that the national self-interest is freedom. It seems like clear that that's the point of having a concept of national self-interest, but I want to give you full credit for conceptualizing that. And I mean, that adds so much clarity when you talk about, well, America has to defend its interests. You think of, well, our military bases and protect us from invasion, maybe stop foreign countries from killing Americans abroad as they do. But this throws it all in focus. Kudos to that. To you for
Thank
that.
You.
Also, I want to now take up, I have four things marked in the book, and since I'm in the foreign policy section, losing my voice again, I want to read one sentence in the first paragraph. It's going to seem, you're going to say, yeah, of course, yes. Without freedom, man cannot exercise his basic means of survival. That is a really good condensed formulation.
Thank you.
You all think, yeah, right, Ayn Rand has said that. Not exactly. And it's not like a new connection, because she said force is anti-mind. The mind cannot be forced. Man's mind is man's basic means of survival. But this formulation puts it all together in one sentence that it would not occur to you to write this sentence, believe me, if you were trying to write on your own. You would write, I would write something like, therefore man needs freedom in order to use successfully his tool of survival, which is close, but this is much better. Without freedom, man cannot exercise his basic means of survival.
Yeah. Thank you.
You take up in that, why is it not collective? It's two things that, you know, it would be a natural objection for anyone. Why is it not collectivist to talk about the nation's interest or the national self-interest? And like a corollary to that, isn't that an amoral concept? Because, you know, Germany in the Nazi years was after Germany's self-interest. And you skillfully and accurately answer both charges, leaving the reader with perfect clarity on those, on that topic. And that's again something Ayn Rand never discussed directly and was always in the back of my mind. Well, is it right to talk about national self-interest? But by connecting it to freedom, and freedom as in the self-interest of each individual, you make it pellucidly clear that Germany was not pursuing self-interest, not just because of that connection, but nakedly they were pursuing the interests of the rulers, of the regime, of holding down the German people, not of allowing them to flourish.
Yeah, was it the thing that I was important to me to establish was the connection between these last two chapters and the rest of the book. In other words, I had shown extensively earlier what self-interest means, why selfishness means rationality, why each individual needs to exercise his mind in order to achieve his self-interest. And then it's just an application to on a national level where it reduces to the individual. The national
yes.
self-interest is not simply freedom as such, freedom in the world, it's the freedom of each of the individual citizens of that country. That is what constitutes a nation's self-interest. Just as, you know, you can talk loosely about the public interest. Now, the public interest is an anti-concept as it's used. But you can say, if you want to really know what is in the interest of society as a whole, well, it's whatever is in the interest of each individual member who constitutes that society, and that is, politically, his individual freedom to pursue his own life and his own values.
I have several sections I want to call to people's attention. Earlier in the book, I'm leaving foreign policy now. According to, this is under the collectivist straitjacket, It's a connection between altruism and collectivism. Again, I just think this is so skillfully done. According to the tenets of altruism, people are morally entitled to have their unfulfilled needs met. I guess that should be read a little different. According to the tenets of altruism, people are morally entitled to have their unfulfilled needs met. The welfare state ensures that they are politically entitled as well. Food, housing, education, medical care. If people lack it, the government supplies it. That's terrific. If people lack it, the government... You've connected it now to the deep... Although I don't know how many people will hear Galt's speech in their mind as I did. But the climax of the treatment of altruism in Galt's speech is the connection of altruism to death through the concept of lack. Whatever the value involved, people's lack of it, she says, it gives them the entitlement and the rights. And this is so recognizable without getting onto that level at all. Food, housing, education, medical care. If people lack it, the government supplies it. Yeah, that's what we're living with. That is such a great encapsulation.
Yeah, and that comes in the chapter where, let me add as an aside, where I want to show why the welfare state, why the idea that the government has to provide for everyone's needs leads to a regulatory state. If the government provides for you, if you have to be taken care of, that means you have to be controlled.
That's what I was turning to. Let me turn to that statement.
I'm sorry to anticipate you. Okay.
Subhead, to be taken care of is to be controlled. But if people have to be taken care of by the state, if they cannot be left on their own, then they cannot be trusted to make decisions by themselves. If they are to be fed, they must be told what food is to be permitted to them. This is why, for example, we are given state-approved nutritional requirements by the Department of Agriculture, .. I mean, that's a great connection, that your mind is not competent to provide for your own producing of wealth and choosing of it. Well, if you can't get a job and provide for your food, surely you're not capable of deciding what food. It's the mind that's invalidated, you see. No one thinks, aside from paraplegics, people are unemployed because they're too weak to get out of their chairs. I mean, that's not a view. We don't have trillions in welfare because people are muscularly weak. It's they don't have the ability, which means that they don't have the mental facilities, the intellectual strength to make a contribution that will be paid for. Well, if that's true, they certainly can't use that defective mind to decide anything.
Yeah, that's why we have a paternalistic state exactly on that premise. You know, I give the example in the book, which many people maybe have heard me say already, to really highlight this mindset, this altruistic mindset, the paternalistic mindset. In New York, there is a soup kitchen in the Bowery, you know, for people, all these homeless people come and they give them food. And they're supposed to be, these are supposedly people who are starving, have no food, have no means of supporting themselves. So they come and they get fed and they get one or two meals a day. This sustains their lives. Now, somebody donated a whole bunch of food one day to the soup kitchen. It was fried chicken. So this is going to be a treat for all these poor, starving people, right? And the people in charge threw it out. They threw away the chicken. because it contained trans fat. And the government has decided that food with trans fat in it is bad for you. So they threw it out, and I mean, just think of how this exemplifies this idea that the government is your nanny. The government has to decide every single thing you do, every morsel you put in your mouth has to be done by the approval of the government.
I want to turn to an entirely different subject, and now it's about the way you think, my topic, not just how well you express thoughts, but this is on method. This is a section, self-interest makes objective thinking possible. The obvious question at this point is how the regulators themselves can know what is good. If people are impulse-driven dupes who cannot be trusted to overcome their, quote, inner homers, Homer Simpson was used, you know, from The Simpsons earlier, as someone who cannot resist his urges. If people are impulse-driven dupes who cannot be trusted to overcome their inner homers, what makes government officials supposedly immune? What makes them the adults while the rest of us are regarded as helpless children? Now, you've heard that 100 times from conservatives, right? Well, the government officials are no gods. They're the same crooked timber of humanity that the rest of us. How come they are supposed to know better than me what's in my best interest, right? And that's where it ends, right? Yeah. The hypocrites. But Peter answers the question. It's not rhetorical for him. What makes them the adults while the rest of us are regarded as helpless children? There's only one answer. Their altruistic motives. Self-interest is disparagingly regarded as a corrupting force, not just morally, but cognitively. In this view, the person who benefits from some action is incapable of thinking objectively about it. Dot, dot, dot. If self-interest distorts thought, who then can think logically about such matters? Only the disinterested. Now, you see what I'm saying? I was very impressed that Peter... It goes down. He says, yeah, there's a contradiction here. There's people, we elect them. You didn't make that point, but it could be made. The same stupid people pick their rulers who are supposed to know better than they do. But then you go to why. Why that does make sense on the morality of altruism or on the epistemology of altruism. So, I want to pause on that because that's the proper method. You observe a contradiction, you say, well, why? What? It's not leaping out at people. Why does it not appear to be a contradiction to them?
Yeah. Thank you. And I to stress this, the point is they aren't hypocrites, and the whole structure of the welfare state as against a proper type of government, is that the government is disinterested. All the people, all the politicians making decisions are making decisions on behalf of others. They're taking care of the other. They're the nannies for the others. The nannies are disinterested when it comes to their own lives. It's not themselves they're benefiting. It's all these helpless, poor people who can't fend for themselves. So everything the government does, because it's, quote, disinterested, is objective. So the government can set up a social security system, for example, and can't trust each individual to decide how to set aside savings for his own retirement. The government officials can do it, and they've got this whole Ponzi scheme that if it's done privately would put everybody in jail, the social security system. But it's revered because the government officials know what's best for us because it's not what's best for them. They're doing it altruistically.
As someone once said, the private individuals are motivated by greed, and government officials are motivated by love.
Yeah.
Taking this to the extreme. And that kind of makes sense of everything, you know, then, and it gives you something to argue about. If you're talking to a neutral or left-leaning person, and you say, well, what makes a government official smarter than the average people? You know, he might attempt it. But if you say, well, wait a minute, are you assuming that because private individuals have something to gain from getting the right answer, but government officials could care less, that somehow makes their judgment better? Of course, I slanted it in a way. But there's content now to talk about rather than just, oh, there's a contradiction here in the other viewpoint. So that's the method. When you ask a question of yourself, answer it. You know, people say, what's wrong with me that I don't X? Okay, what is wrong that you don't X? All right, I want to go now to the final one, and then we'll open up the discussion. It looks like there's two final ones. Oh, that was our... Okay. Oh, I already covered it. It's to be taken care of is to be controlled. So let me say another word of praise. I had not really paid attention before in the earlier edition to the chapter titles and subtitles. And they're really good. So for instance, altruism versus rights. Subtitle is freedom is negated by a duty to sacrifice. The meaning of rights. The sole political system that repudiates servitude. The equality fraud. And the next chapter is entitled The Collectivist Straitjacket. To be taken care of is to be controlled. Regulations victimize both producers and consumers. The selfish motive to make products safe. Self-interest makes objective thinking possible. That's quite a title. Self-interest makes objective thinking possible. That's completely at odds with everything, at least since Kant. You know, Kant is exactly the opposite. Yeah. Sacrificing the rational to the irrational, which is my favorite point about regulations. The black hole of selflessness is the chapter title. Isn't that good? The goal of self-sacrifice, choosing to live. And then the epilogue's a nation's self-interest, the path to success. And to a nation's self-interest, the path to failure, which is how altruism has destroyed our ability to defend ourselves. That's all I had prepared. Peter, before we open the chat, is there anything you wanted to say about your favorite points in the book?
Here, I could tell you this. You know, I was interviewed some time ago by Don Watkins, and he asked me, what's my favorite chapter? And I didn't have a good answer. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I didn't have an answer naming a specific chapter. It just occurred to me that what I really like is the logical structure of the book. I just like the way the chapters are organized, and if you want to get into it, I can explain how I chose the sequence and the structure of the arguments that I needed to make throughout the book. But I'm very pleased with the structure and the organization of the book.
That's a good thing to be pleased about.
I'd like to hear Peter's comment on that.
Sam Axton says, yes, explain the structure.
All right, here it goes. I'll try to do it quickly. The first two chapters are obvious. If I'm discussing selfishness and altruism, I have to debunk the misconceptions that people have about each. So the first chapter is, here's what altruism really is. It's not helping a blind man cross the street or giving your neighbor a hot meal when his house is burned down through no fault of his own. It's being a servant to his needs. You understand. So that's what the first chapter is. What altruism, how altruism imposes shackles on everybody. Then once I've done that, the next obvious question is, well, okay, if altruism is bad, if altruism amounts to servitude or slavery, the alternative couldn't be selfishness, could it? And so I have to explain, well, here's the straw man that's been created in people's minds about selfishness, that they regard selfishness as somebody who just lies and cheats and tramples over bodies to achieve his ends, that is not what genuine selfishness is. Rather, so I go on to chapter two, explain what selfishness actually is. Then once you've got those two concepts sort of clear, altruism and selfishness, and I'm obviously defending selfishness, the question becomes, well, how does morality fit in? Okay, I accept you should be selfish, you should pursue your own self-interest, but you don't need moral principles for that. Altruism is the code that upholds moral principles, isn't it? So I have to explain two things. One, how and why self-interest requires moral principles, just regardless of the principles, what they are, but just it requires guidance over the course of a lifetime because you have to make choices, you're not programmed, etc. So I show that, and then secondarily to show how specific principles that people regard correctly as and properly as moral, how they apply to self-interest. And I had to choose three. I chose honesty, justice, and integrity, where those are the virtues, as against some of the other objectivist virtues, that don't need a lot of explanation. Almost everybody understands why honesty is a moral virtue and why justice is good and why integrity is good. I just needed to explain how does this connect to self-interest, because most people have exactly the opposite view. They'll support, they think honesty requires sacrifice and et cetera. So I did that. And then the second half of that chapter is to show how altruism negates moral principles. It negates it not only because altruism says you have to sacrifice everything, including your moral principles, if it's to serve others in need. If someone wants you to lie, if he's in need, then you should be dishonest. If someone needs you to be unjust and to deal with him through mercy rather than justice, that's what else. So altruism negates moral principles, and it negates the whole idea of moral principles, because moral principles are supposed to be guidance. It's supposed to tell you, here's what you should do under certain circumstances and so forth. If you just tell someone, do whatever you feel like doing, that's not moral guidance. That's the abdication of moral guidance. Yet that's what altruism does. Altruism says not that you should do whatever you feel like doing, but you should do whatever your neighbor feels like doing, because there's no way to objectively define need. If you want to define need objectively, then a person's need is reject altruism and assume responsibility for your own life. But if you accept altruism, then you've elevated someone's need, which only means his wishes. Whatever he wishes, you have to provide. He wants your money, you have to provide it. He wants your knowledge. You have your energies. You have to provide it, etc. So there's no altruism is tantamount to do whatever you feel like doing. Just transfer to your neighbor. That was chapter three. I'm just going to go through chapter four because I'll go on for too long. Then the last chapter, the next chapter four, which I'm going to end on, that I had to make the point to address the following concern. I've got the first three chapters. I've explained altruism and selfishness. I've explained moral principles. But when you have an organized society, how could that work? How could that be practical? Doesn't everybody understand that there's a conflict between the public interest and private interest? So sometimes the quote common good has to take precedence over your self-interest. Doesn't that therefore undercut selfishness? So I had to deal with that whole issue of public interest versus private interest and explain why there is no conflict and why public interest is an invalid concept. I'm going to end there because I'm going to take the rest of the time if I go through the rest of the book.
Yeah, well, let's schematize it. So the first theme of the first chapter is altruism is slavery to others.
Yes.
And then the next one is selfishness is not enslaving others, sacrificing them to self. But, let me even schematize more. First is what altruism means. The second one is what selfishness doesn't mean and does mean. The third is the objectivity through principles of egoism, or is it not of altruism? Let's see. Is that chapter more on there are no principles under altruism or principles are only under egoism? How would you
exactly put it? Half for each.
Okay. The role of principles for egoism and altruism. Okay. And the fourth is the myth of public interest, which is, how would you put this into the schematic form?
The public interest is a meaningless notion designed to rationalize altruism, designed to rationalize self-sacrifice.
So would it be what altruism means on a social scale? It's not quite that broad.
It's specifically the public interest. It's specifically addressing this idea of the public interest and demolishing it and showing there is no conflict between public interest and private interest. And that as a side point, the whole genesis of this concept of public interest was to make self-sacrifice seem necessary and practical in society. I can give you one sentence summations of the rest of the chapters, but I think people want to, chime in. So
yeah, I think we should.
Somebody
pointed out that there's an Audible book of the first one.
It's on Audible, and I think it'll be only available for another month or so. I don't know whether ARI is going to make an audio version or not. So the version was licensed, and the license expires, I think, in February or March, and I don't think it's going to be available after that, except unless ARI decides to do it.
Okay.
Also a question of what about a Kindle version?
Oh, good. I'm glad you asked that. Yes, I'm told every day we're waiting for Amazon to tell us they've put out the Kindle version. It's terrible. It seems that ARI has no control over how and what Amazon does. We just have to wait and sit idly by. Someday they're going to make it available. They're working on it. And can I just add one point? While you're waiting for the Kindle edition, those of you who have the book, who've read the book, I think some people are reluctant to post reviews of it on Amazon because they think, well, the book already the original book already has been reviewed. But don't look at it that way. Amazon looks at this as a new book. So feel free to post your comments or reviews on it. If you want to comment on the new chapters, you can. If you want to comment on the old chapters, that's perfectly acceptable. But they're treating this as a new book.
Good. And people are always asking, what can I do? What would an activist do? Reviewing this book on Amazon is direct intellectual revolutionary action. Robbie, I guess that's Robbie Segler, if he's on here, says that he tried to download it from Audible. The first title that pops up is, when he puts in, I guess, The Tyranny of Need, The Tyranny of Merit. Are you aware of that book?
Yeah, that is a book by, I think, Richard Sandel, I think, this well-known best-selling author at Harvard who's got a whole series of books on ethics. It's exactly, as you could imagine, the antithesis of my book. So someday, I'd love to have a debate with him.
Yeah.
So anyone who can arrange that, feel free.
Okay. Are there hands up? I don't see any hands up.
Not just at this second, but
Here's
Pooja has raised her hand. Pooja has raised her hand.
I just wanted to point out that I see at least two books that have been written as a summary or analysis of Peter's book. So there's one by Era Graphics and one by Alisa Brunette. And this is it just came up in the list. So I was curious if Peter knew about them or.
Well, I have this. Can you see this book?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's one of
them. This is the one you're talking about, Pooja?
This is one, and then the other one is by Alisa Burnett.
What's the title? Do you know?
It says Summary in Defense of... Summary. It just says Summary in Defense of Selfishness, Peter Schwartz.
Okay, I've never heard of that. I just happened upon this. It's a little booklet. It's about, 15 pages, 20 pages. And I know nothing about this author. It's not very well done, but his heart is in the right place. He genuinely wanted to summarize my book. He does this apparently for a number of books. If you look up this author, which is Ada Graphics, that's not the author's name, I guess that's the company name. He does this for a number of books. I guess he makes money selling it. I'm glad it's out. It's more publicity for the book, though it's as I said, it's not terrifically done. The other one I'd never heard of, I'm going to try to find out about it. Thank you.
I think it would be impossible for a non-objectivist to really get this.
Yeah.
Or if they did, they become an objectivist upon getting it. Right?
Yes, that's
so there's so many good formulations and sure-footed moves in this book that I was kind of taken aback on reading it the second time, that with the thought that, geez, nobody's going to realize how hard it is to write like this. Nobody's going to realize that until you try it yourself, if you sit down. Now, let's explain about what's bad about the regulatory state. It controls you. I mean, you try to write it out. It is really hard. Jay has his hand up.
Hi, Peter. I just wanted to thank you from everything I'm hearing here. I just ordered it on Amazon. I'm always looking for formulations that make things more clear. Harry, you talked about non-objectivist not getting it, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I find in my conversations with people constantly, it could be in a restaurant, it could be a waitress, it can be somebody sitting next to me when traveling on a plane or in a hotel restaurant, nice restaurant where I'm meeting other traveling professionals. I have conversations about philosophy and they're amazed and they're delighted because they just make it so accessible to the non-objectivist, just so down to earth. I mean, even things like saying, you know, most ethics is based on a list of do's and don'ts from some authority, whether it's political, religious, parental, or corporate. And I say none of the above. The alternative is everybody knows that if you lie to yourself and everybody else all the time, there are natural consequences. And they smile and say, yeah, of course. And if you tell the truth as best you can to yourself and other people all the time, there are natural consequences. And they say, yeah, of course. So, well, that goes back to Aristotle. It goes back to the fact that things are what they are. And if they are what they are, then it's a matter of being honest about what's out there, what's in here. And then in my professional context, identify value, try and build it, validate it, build trust, repeat. And that's how my teams develop.
Maybe you should write a book.
I think I should. I need help writing. Could you help me, Peter? I need professional help, as
not
I said.
Not at the moment.
All right.
There are other people who can help you.
Well, I'm open to offers for help because I've been working on this for decades, and they're just little snippets, and they all tie together, and it goes from the theoretical to the practical, and people say, wow, it all connects. It's all the same, integrated whole. And I say, yep. Yeah,
well, Peter, when he used to teach, when Peter taught writing, he had what I think you call the Luder principle.
Moocher principle.
Moocher principle.
Yeah. Moocher?
Moocher.
Moocher principle.
Moocher principle. You want to explain that? It's right up Jay's alley here.
Well, that's a principle which says that you can know the derivative before you know the fundamental. So I asked the following question of the class. In Atlas Shrugged, you've got portrayals of people who are characterized as moochers and are being portrayed negatively. So the question is, why would the reader regard these portrayals as negative when the fundamental has not yet been presented? It comes later away at the end, let's say at least in Galt's speech, where he explains fundamentally what is wrong with altruism and how it's on the death premise and selfishness is on the life premise. But way before that, how do you negatively assess moochers? And the point is, when you're in writing, you don't always have to present the fundamental of everything you're trying to say. You can speak, you can say it's wrong to steal without having to get to the principle of man's, the rational mind is man's means of survival, and et cetera. It's implicit in the derivative. It's, if you say this guy's a moocher, all of the fundamentals are implicit there, but you don't necessarily know it. And you don't have to feel that you've always got to present the fundamental, because then every article you write has to start with existence exists and A is A, and let me proceed from there.
And many people will just glaze over and not get to what you want to really communicate.
Yeah.
I based on what I said before with my example about ethics, I realize we're running over here a little bit, if that's okay. I realize that, people agree that, yeah, if you lie and if you tell the truth, you get different consequences, and therefore there's reality. But at some point I get into, well, that's theory of human action, which is formally called ethics. That's what ethics should be about. And in order to answer questions in ethics, you got to ask questions about how do I know? And then introduce the concept of epistemology. And then in order to ask, how do I know, you got to ask questions about what's knowable, for which there's very little to say. Aristotle said most of it, things are what they are. They can only act as they can act by their nature. And it's exactly that. It's not starting from the fundamentals, but getting people very quickly to them and seeing that there's something there of interest and it's accessible.
In Galt's speech, she began writing Galt's speech by starting with existence exists and building up from there. And after a while, she realized, no, this is not the right way to communicate. So she doesn't get to Existence Exists until about 10 pages in, maybe even more. And she begins with the moral issue, the moral revolution, and gets into objectivity and existence from the ethics. And she was thereby distinguishing the order of learning from the order of demonstration.
Exactly.
And it's easy to confuse that. And I like to attack that by asking people, when I talk on this objectivist, when I talk on a subject like art, say I'm talking on art, where do you begin a lecture on art? How many of you think the place to begin is to give a definition? Art is a selective recreation. And a lot of hands go up. And they say, no, that is not. That is the later conclusion. You begin with the facts, the phenomena. And in the moocher description, people, moochers, everybody can recognize a mooch. I mean, she didn't make up that term. They just haven't induced that's the meaning of everything that I've accepted as moral. Is it mooching is the essence of morality. I've never realized that yet. Okay, so we are a little over time. Thank you, Peter, so much for coming. And thank you for writing the second version of the book.
My pleasure. And thanks for
publishing. And the first version. And I recommend everybody sit down with it and not just say, yeah, but think about it as you read it. It will repay with great dividends that effort. So on behalf of Peter and me, and maybe even Jean, I say thank you for coming, and I'll see you next Sunday on Meeting of the Minds.
Okay, thanks, Harry.
Thank you, Harry.